Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Shweta Mishra, your host, joining you from India. We are living in an era of personalized medicine where we are increasingly recognizing the value of right treatment to the right patient at the right time. Over the last few years, breakthrough advancements in the field of fertility has helped many infertile couples start a family successfully. Innovations like in non-invasive tests that can identify genetic abnormalities, multi-gene panel tests that have brought personalized medicine to reproductive health. This evening, we are talking to Harvard-educated reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Amy, more famously known as the Egg Whisperer, embryologist and founder of Cellmatics, Dr. Piraya Yirtas-Baim, and neuroscientist and CEO of Episona, Dr. Alan Hersager, about how recent advances in personalized medicine can help physicians help their patients reach their family-building goals in a more focused way. My co-host for today's show is Emily Dubin-Field, who became a mom through surrogacy and blogs about her fertility journey at fieldfertility.com. I welcome you all to Cure Talks, Dr. Amy, Dr. Baim, Dr. Hersager, and Emily. And I extend a warm welcome to all our listeners, and I would like to remind them that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the end of the show. So please email your questions to shweta@trialx.com. And if you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad, and we will bring you on air to ask them. You can also post your questions on curetalks.com website as you listen to the talk. So I'll start with you, Dr. Amy. Could you please set the ground for our audience by telling us in layman terms what does personalized medicine mean in general and in the context of infertility, and why is that important?
Absolutely. So personalized medicine is when treatment is customized for an individual patient. And when we're using personalized fertility medicine, it means that your doctor is digging deep into finding out as much as possible about you and looking at all your fertility factors and then taking all that information and developing a treatment plan based on what's learned. So rather than just, you know, trying treatment and seeing if it's going to work, really finding out what your fertility factors are is the premise of personalized fertility medicine.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Amy. Dr. Baim, you were on the front lines of the personalized medicine revolution during your doctoral work in embryology at Memorial Sloan Kettering and Weill Cornell. What was your motivation behind creating this multi-gene panel test, Fertilome? And also tell us about the Say the F Word campaign and why did you start it?
Hi. So as you mentioned, I really had the benefit of being on the front lines of seeing personalized medicine, the way that Dr. Amy described it, really become standard of care in oncology. And the inspiration for me to found Cellmatics and for us to develop the Fertilome test began really years ago when I realized that the same technology and the same paradigms were really not coming to reproductive health. This was a time in, during which the human genome had recently been decoded. You know, the feeling was that, you know, in the case of oncology, they really had to invent the technology and bring personalized medicine to the field, right? So oncology and personalized mm-hmm. medicine really grew up together. My feeling was we already have a playbook. We have a path. You know, oncology has really led the way. What we have to do is take these tools and just apply them to our field. And so to me, that felt like something that was really important to do, and I didn't see anybody going after that, and so I felt that it was important for me. Also, on a personal level, the year that I founded the company, I turned 30, and like many women, I was using age as the primary, you know, guiding post of when I should start worrying and thinking a bit more about my reproductive clock. And I had friends at that age starting to get married, starting to try to conceive, and I saw that in their early 30s they were already struggling. And so I knew that, you know, that from a technological standpoint we could do better, and then from a personal standpoint I knew that we had to. So that was what inspired me to start the company and for us to really start down the path of what ended up being over 7 years of groundbreaking research to identify the genetic factors that to date have, in a clinically validated way, shown the greatest association with different reproductive conditions. And we're really proud that in 2017 we launched this test. We got full regulatory approval for it here in the United States. Now that we're looking to scale this and make sure that every individual who really, like Dr. Amy said, wants to dive deep and really understand why this is happening to them or whether they're at risk for this to happen to them, we want them to have access to those answers. And we think that one of the things that is still a hindrance beyond the technology, beyond the fact that the Fertilome genetic test is now available, is that women still feel like fertility is something that they can't really talk about or even bring up with their physicians. So on the path to developing the test, we also did a lot of research and surveyed women, millennial-aged women, about how they think about their health and their reproductive health. And we were really surprised and also saddened to learn that over 60% of the women that we surveyed said that they don't talk to their friends about fertility at all, even though it's something that's on their mind. One of the statistics that we found just really chilling was that one in five women in this population who had experienced a miscarriage had not even told their partner that it had happened, right? And so I think for us, we realized we saw a lot of the women's empowerment movements that have really been gaining momentum over the last year. And we said, we have to do something. We have to create a platform to start removing some of the stigma that is holding women back from getting the help that they need, talking to their closest loved ones, their partners, and even talking to their physicians. We learned that a quarter of women, and others have shown this as well, who are trying to have a baby have not even broached the topic with their OBGYN, right? So we want women to proactively start taking control of their reproductive health, and we wanted to start a dialogue. So we started the Say the F Word campaign. It's a hashtag campaign. We also have a website called WeSayTheFWord.com. And we are partnered with a number of other great allies, including Maven and Progeny. And we are, Cellmatics is pledging to donate a dollar up to $25,000 to women's organizations that we're also partnered with, including Planned Parenthood, the Women's March, Resolve, and the Endometriosis Foundation of America. So we're really excited. Just in the first couple of weeks, we've already had thousands of women pledged to say the F word and have started to really share their stories, including women who have shared, for example, that they haven't yet even thought about whether they want to have a family one day, but they certainly know they want the option. And so it's been really exciting to see from, you know, women who are experiencing devastating miscarriages, the really difficult, journey of going through infertility, all the way to women who haven't even yet begun their journeys. We're starting to bring those stories into the light, and that's really exciting for us.
Right. Yeah. Thank you so much for your answer, Dr. Baim. Dr. Horsagar, I'll move on to you. Could you please explain what the field of epigenetics is and in what ways can it be related to infertility? And what is the information that Episona provides that can help patients and their specialists?
Sure, sure. I appreciate you having me on the show. And just to carry off what Dr. Baim was talking about, if women's reproductive health is a difficult topic to broach, men's reproductive health is even more so in many ways. So I very much appreciate what she's trying to do there. So we really got into this opportunity realizing that there was a real absence of ways of evaluating men's reproductive health. You essentially have the semen analysis, which is looking at count, morphology, and motility. So are sperm present? Are they swimming properly? And does the shape of those cells, does that look normal? And unfortunately, that's a fairly poor indication of infertility. There's actually been a growing body of work in epigenetics and specifically in reproductive health and men's health over the last decade or so. And what epigenetics is essentially the study of a system of molecules that sit on top of the DNA to regulate which genes are active and inactive, and that affects gene expression. So in each cell of your body, the genome is essentially identical, But the reason those different cells do different things and have different phenotypes is because of epigenetics. So different genes are expressed in different cell types. And then this normal molecular pattern that sits on top of the DNA, that can be disrupted. And when it's disrupted, that can lead to problems with health. And in our particular instance, we're looking at disruptions in the sperm, and that we see related to infertility. And we see that manifest in two different ways. One is around things that might impact fertilization. And then and more interestingly, we see these disruptions happen in genes that are important for embryo development. So we see even if you do get to fertilization, successful fertilization, there still may be very big difficulties in developing the embryo properly to result in a pregnancy and a live birth that may be the result of a problem in the sperm epigenome. And so that's really how we inform on the clinical process and the clinical treatment process, is by understanding problems, first recognizing, is there a problem on the male side, even if the sperm semen analysis looks normal, and then does that suggest there might be problems with fertilization issues, or might there be problems with embryo development? And that helps clinicians ultimately guide their treatment.
Okay, yeah. Thank you so much for your answer, Dr. Horsagar. With this, I'll invite Emily on the panel. Emily Dubinfield, you are there. Please ask
yes,
your
I'm
questions
here.
To the panel.
Okay, great. Thank you
hi.
So much. Hi, Shweta. I really appreciate this, and I love what you're doing and what CureTox is doing. So hi to all the doctors. Just really quickly, I really, really appreciate this panel. And this topic today. And I, on a personal note, really, really resonate with Dr. Byme and Dr. Horsager with what you're saying about female infertility and, saying that F word, as well as male infertility. So, I know Shweta asked me to be on the panel today because I am, an infertility survivor, if you will. I have a miracle baby who was born via surrogate. She just turned 3 years old, but 6 years ago, we started on our path to have a child, and like so many of your patients, and I know so many of your listeners, my husband and I were doing everything right. Young, healthy couple, I was 30 years old at a regular period, and we could not get pregnant. And at first, my husband went in for his sperm test. This is now 6 years ago, and it looked like he was the problem. And my husband was devastated. And later, in doing a lot more tests, turned out, the issues on his side were solvable, and I was really, really the issue, extremely challenging. I've put together a bunch of questions that come from my personal experience in hopes that a lot of our listeners today will resonate with it. So thank you guys for being so open and being here today. And I have questions for each of you. I'm going to kind of jump back and forth, but I'd love to create this and have this be as interactive as possible. So if I ask a question to one of you and somebody else wants to answer, please jump in. And we'll go for the next 20-ish minutes or so. And then I know Shweta has some more questions at the end. So Dr. Amy, hi. Happy to be
hi.
On another Cure Talk with
yes.
you.
Me too.
I mentioned just a few minutes ago that, when my husband and I were going through infertility treatments, went through 3 years of it, but we're now going back 3 to 6 years. And I know so much has changed in the field of fertility in that time, just in my time. But I'm really curious and wondering if you could further help, set the stage for the panel discussion today of how have you seen the role of new technologies change from when you first started practicing to now?
Yeah, so I've seen tremendous changes. I've been practicing now for 10 years. This is my 10th year in practice since graduating from infertility fellowship. Yep, so you can imagine all the things that I've seen, starting with changes in PGS technology. And for those of you who don't know what PGS, that's where you can check an embryo to see if it has a balanced set of chromosomes. And we've seen that technology going from ELISA to now NGS, or next-gen sequencing. So imagine using a magnifying glass to using a microscope. That's kind of the analogy that I use. We're still not 100%, but we're getting closer and closer. So there are patients that I can say that I can help today that I wasn't able to help even, let's say, 2 years ago in 2016. So it's the development of tests like Episona and Fertilome that have given me information about patients that I would have never known that I could have had in the past that having today have really helped a lot. So, for example, being able to have a personalized transfer window through testing on someone's lining, that's the ERA test, a receptiva test, looking at their endometriosis, also carrier screening technology. We were doing genotyping in 2008, now sequencing, and then more recently looking at mitochondrial DNA levels in embryos and measuring that and being able to give someone their implantation rate of success based on not just how their embryo looks, and the chromosomes, but also about how much energy an embryo has. So all of this together has really made tremendous changes in how we can take care of patients, and has really moved forward the field of personalized fertility medicine, because without these tools, it was just really just trial and error, you know, just do this, and if that didn't work, then try this, if that didn't work. But now with this technology, we're able to just kind of change how we approach patient care, and it's really awesome and exciting.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. I think, you know, for all the, you know, women and men who are listening today and thinking about, you know, about their hope and, you know, being hopeful and just knowing that, you know, medicine is advancing all the time. And it's just amazing for you to think that, you know, you couldn't help a patient 2 years ago that you could maybe help today. And that makes you think of what you could do in, you know, a year from now. So I think that, you know, there's a lot more hope. You know, I know I really felt that, you know, 10 years ago, my husband and I would not have a biological child. So it's, you know, really impressive everything that's going on. And I'd love for you to take another minute and maybe expand a little bit about your particular practice, you know, and also maybe
right.
among your colleagues too, are, right. you know, you seeing other reproductive endocrinologists, you know, hesitant to implement some of these new tests or whatnot, or what about your clinic? You know, it sounds like you are super embracing all of this, but I'm just curious, you know, a patient and figuring out what doctor to go to, you know, what should they be asking and what's your clinic doing that you think is maybe standing apart from the rest or from some of your other colleagues?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I've coined a phrase called the egg whisperer diet, and no, it is not a diet. I'm the worst cook. It's not a recipe for something, but it's a really simple approach that all patients can take when thinking about their fertility care. So it's really easy. So D stands for diagnosis, and I really dive deep using all these personalized fertility medicine tests that we've talked about. The I stands for IVF, or you don't need to do IVF, you can just do treatment. The E stands for endometrial testing before transfer, and then the T is transfer. So I feel like if I can just, you know, talk about this egg whisperer diet, then patients everywhere can realize that these tests are available for them, and then they'll be in good position to be as successful as possible and have less heartache before they, you know, less heartache and less trauma, because we all know that fertility treatments that don't work, it's really, really stressful when that happens. So
yeah.
My goal is, you know, by finding out early what treatment is best for a patient, they can then do things on their own without anyone's help. And I know it's hard to believe that a doctor would want to see less patients and do less treatment, but I totally do. Like, I tell patients, I want to teach you what it would take for you to get pregnant at home without my help, so that if I ultimately needed to help you with, let's say, IVF, we're in the best position to be successful. So, for example, look at the Episona test, and we learned that a man's sperm quality is low. We see what the issues are, then we can put him through a sperm fitness challenge that could possibly help, let's say supplements, exercise, you know, simple lifestyle stuff like, you know, no pizza and beer, stuff like that. And then whenever we end up doing treatment, if we end up ultimately having to do IVF, we know that we're going to have more beautiful blastocysts, that we won't look back and say, hey, why didn't we know this up front before we just spent, you know, $20,000 plus on a failed cycle?
Right.
I wish someone would have taught me this up front, and that's my goal. I want to talk to people about what all the tests are that they can do ahead of their treatment, so they can get themselves in the best shape of their lives, be really informed going forward, do enough cycles so they, you know, so that they have the embryos that they need for their future family, so that they're going into it with all the knowledge and information they need for them.
I think that is so well said. And, you know, as somebody who is so open about her infertility journey and surrogacy journey, I have prospective, you know, parents or people who are struggling to conceive all the time can talk to me. And I can't tell you, I mean, just this week, I probably heard two people complain of, I wish my doctor had told me this, or, you know, now this new doctor is telling me this, or, you know, and this is now within the last year, you know. So I love the, you know, your diet and the D and diagnosis. So, you know, are there certain things you would say to somebody, you know, when they're first with you? I know it's a little off topic, but I just want to go there because I think it's such an important nugget, you know, of some key questions that people should be asking when they start with their fertility doctor.
No, the first question I ask my patients, the first thing that I ask when someone sits in front of me, I say, what do you think is wrong? Because people know, they have a really good gut feeling. Like I have people that say, you know, I feel like there's something, like I'm attacking the embryo. And I know that for some doctors that might not make them feel comfortable, but I can tell you through the test, like Fertilome, I can say, wow, I just looked at your fertility gene test and you're right. There's so much going on with your immune system. And if I didn't have this test, how would I know what to do? How would I know what test to do, what to offer you? And so that is actually one of the first questions that I ask people. And then the other thing is, it's not just about eggs, right? So it's just three things, eggs, sperm, tubes.
Right.
You got to look at everything because you can't go to donor egg and then never have looked at sperm, just assumed everything that was going to be great. And then you find out that sperm, you know, like you shared, was an issue that could have been addressed like years ago. So, you know, that's kind of my approach, really listening to the patient, doing focused tests on what they bring to me is what they feel the issue is, and then ultimately look at everything and not ignore, something like a fallopian tube, even if you're doing IVF, because we know that having a hydrosalpinx, for example, or having scar tissue in the uterus can affect the success of future transfers.
Right, absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. And you dive perfectly into, I'm going to jump back or I'm going to jump over to Dr. Vine. Thanks so much for being here. And I know, Dr. Amy, you were just speaking, you know, a little bit about the Fertilome test. I know Shweta mentioned it too at the beginning. And I, you know, I know this is your test. And I would love for you just to take a little bit and, you know, tell us more about what it involves and why should women talk to their clinics about having this multi-gene panel done. Some are, like Dr. Amy, but perhaps others aren't. And so I'm hoping you can arm our female patients with this information today. So I'll let you take it from here.
Absolutely. So I think you really hit the nail on the head earlier by saying that you've had so many friends come to you and say, I just found this out, or I just went to this other doctor, and you know, why didn't I know this earlier in the process? As you know, infertility treatment, it's hard on your wallet, it's hard on your marriage, it's hard on your emotions, it's hard on your body, right? If you're about to go into, right? Yeah, so. Yeah, so if you're about to go into battle, right, and you want to come out on the other end with the outcome that you're hoping for all of that investment across the board, our feeling has always been from day one, why wouldn't you want a very personalized, biological level view of what is going on with you? So Dr. Amy mentioned that, you know, differences in genes related to immune function, for example, are covered on the panel. You really want to know, of the genetic factors that have been clinically validated to date, right? So of the things that we know the most about in 2018, why wouldn't you want to know that before investing all of the other time and energy or all of the follow-up diagnostic tests, right? There's, you know, dozens of tests that could be run on you. Getting a genetic level view of what may be going on under the surface also can help guide you to the first diagnostic test that you should invest in, right? And so I think doctors like Dr. Amy, I think they have it exactly right that they want to get that full picture. And so what's great about the Fertilome test is that it's a simple blood or saliva test that can be taken any day of your cycle. You know, it's done in a physician's office. And what it looks like, what it looks at, are the genes that have been associated with gene alterations that have been associated with the most common reproductive conditions. So a woman taking the test can learn if she's at risk for a condition like PCOS, endometriosis, recurrent pregnancy loss, premature menopause, or also gain insights into the genetic factors that may be contributing to unexplained infertility, which it sounds like your infertility fell into that category for a while after you guys had had realized that it may not just be on the male side, right? You started to dive deeper on your side. And so what we want is we want people to get there faster. And we know that a lot of unexplained infertility, for example, is endometriosis that's gone undiagnosed, or not all PCOS is cookie cutter, right? Women can be right at the edge of where their hormone levels look borderline or normal, but it may be that they're actually on a much more accelerated path to diminished ovarian reserve, so they may not respond as well to fertility drugs. You know, they may get pregnant easily in their first IVF cycle, but when they come back in 2 years or 3 years and they want to expand their family, they may get the bad news that they already have such low ovarian reserve that they're not going to respond to treatment, right? So it's about giving women the power of that information up front. And so we want women to be empowering themselves with this information instead of, you know, some physicians, they take the approach of, well, I've tried everything. I truly don't know what's going on. I'm going to try to Fertilome test, right? So there was a really interesting story of a woman who shared her story with a journalist recently in an article that was very touching to hear. She had experienced 7 pregnancy losses, including 4 failed IVF cycles in the process. And finally got to a physician who said, you know, we have this new test called the Fertilome test. He ran it. He saw that she had an alteration in a gene that was really important for the process of implantation. And he changed a simple thing in her protocol, and she now has her first ongoing pregnancy.
That's unbelievable after all she went through.
Right? I have gone through one devastating pregnancy loss, and when I read her story, I was moved to tears. You know, my husband saw me crying. He said, what's going on? And I just shared the story with him, and he was very moved too, because I just couldn't believe what she had gone through and how easy it was almost, you know, to like have that insight,
right,
make that change, and then she was able to get pregnant. And, you know, I don't want to say to people, oh, if you take the Fertilome test, your doctor's going to know exactly what to do. That's not what I'm trying to say. But to Dr. Amy's point, the needle moves every single year, right? And so, you know, something that wouldn't have been possible, you know, just a few years ago is now possible. And so it's one of those things where, you know, no test, the Fertilome test, you know, no doctor can give you all the answers, you know. But what we can do is we can keep moving the needle forward, right? So this is a patient who the system was not meeting her needs for years, right? And then this new test came along, and in her case, that's how she was able to get there. And so we want physicians to be embracing, you know, the best technology that they can possibly be offering to patients right now who are walking in the door.
Yeah, so well said. And I can't tell you how many people I know who have gone through years and years and years of heartache and then, you know, find out one answer and they're like, oh my gosh. And so, you know, thank you for sharing that and sharing that story. I think it can resonate with so many people who are listening or going to listen to this. You know, so actually just to add a little bit onto my personal story too, I ended up fairly early on, you know, just through blood work, through AMH, FSH, and, you know, a follicle count, being told I'm in early menopause. I was 30 years old. And so that was a huge part of our infertility struggle. And it was just through, you know, the vaginal ultrasound and those 2 blood tests that came when my doctor wanted to run all these tests on me. And I was like, what are you talking about? My husband's the problem. I'm fine. I'm young. I get a period. You know, I had no clue. And I was really shocked to find that out. And IVF hardly ever worked. It's a miracle that, you know, our daughter is my egg and we didn't have to have a donor egg. But I'd like to, you know, take a moment, if you will, and talk about how your test complements maybe those blood tests, or how it does it even better. You know, how does the Fertilome test better diagnose, if you will, let's say early menopause in my situation, or PCOS or endometrial issues?
Absolutely. So I think you used the right word, which is it complements. So we are not saying that genetic risk factors should be replacing other tests, right? But it helps you, again, focus on which tests you should be giving to a woman and maybe when in her life. So let's take premature menopause, which is the example that you gave, and it's one that I can relate to because I also, in my early 30s, I was struggling to conceive, had just experienced a devastating pregnancy loss, and then during the course of getting a workup, found out through the exact same set of tests that I was also on the road to early menopause, and that was a devastating diagnosis to have in your early 30s. When, again, like you said, I had a completely normal, you know, cycle, and I thought everything was fine. And so fast forward, I was actually one of the first people to take the Fertilome genetic test. It's something I dedicated almost a decade of my life to, so I wanted to be one of the first people to find out. And I tested positive for one of our premature menopause markers. For me, it was such a healing experience to test positive for that marker. And it led me to speak to my family and learn that my paternal grandmother may have gone into menopause early, right? And that's something that, I mean, who has talked to their dad about when their dad's mom went into menopause, right? Like, this is something where here I am, an expert in the field, and I never had that data point about my own medical history, okay? So this is something that it helped me feel like it wasn't my fault anymore, because I felt a lot of guilt and shame when I got that diagnosis, and I felt very guilty that it was, quote-unquote, my fault that we were having trouble. You know, I beat myself up about what I did to make this happen. And so to find out that actually I was, like, wired to excel at a lot of things, but it turns out that my ovary was on the, you know, end of the spectrum of humanity of not functioning for as long as other women, right? And so what me and my partner were able to do with that, me and my husband, is we knew we wanted to have a bigger family, and we knew that we had to make this the number one thing in our life. So, you know, we really focused on, you know, trying. We didn't leave a lot of space in between, you know, our babies, and so that's how I was able to action on that information. Now, what was interesting in my case is that my AMH test, which I ran through my OBGYN, I got a message from my doctor saying all your hormone tests were normal. And this was around the time when we were struggling. Because I really knew the data because of my work with Cellmatics, I said, but I want to know the number. And she told me the number. And when I got the number, that's when I knew I had to see a specialist, because I knew that it was the last point on the scale that was considered normal for any woman. And there I was at 32 with that number. That would have been normal for a 4-year-old, but was not normal for a 32-year-old, right? And so that's kind of when we went into the process and learned that if we were to go down the path of IVF, it would be very unlikely to work, you know, because I would not be a good responder to hormone stimulation, et cetera. So very similar to your story. So what I think women can, well, first of all, I think these markers have great utility for someone who's at the beginning of their infertility journey where, for example, you know, we hear a lot that women are so eager to just get to a pregnancy, right? Just, great, we have an embryo, let's go for it, we've waited a long time for this. And what we're seeing physicians are able to do is to get women to just, you know, pause for a minute and say, okay, I know you want this pregnancy, I know you want it next month, but you have this marker, you've got borderline hormone levels, I'm worried about getting you pregnant right now, right? Or I'm worried about getting you pregnant with non-IVF, because what I can't do if I get you pregnant with Clomid or injectables and IUI is I can't then save embryos for when you come back to me in a few years, right? So what we've been seeing is women who know that maybe right around the corner, their cliff is much sooner potentially than other women, they can then be much more proactive and put more embryos away. So we see that. We also know that if we can get this information to women earlier in their lives, then they can adopt a healthier lifestyle, right, which we know that certain lifestyle factors like smoking, things you put on or around your body and that you're exposed to can accelerate ovarian decline. So if you already know you're wired to be on the early end of ovarian decline, there are actions you can take earlier in your life to try to give your ovary its best chance, right? Just like if you know you're at risk for cancer, there are actions you can take lifestyle-wise. For some women, they can freeze their eggs. Right? Or they can freeze more eggs maybe than they were planning to originally. They can try to conceive earlier than they had originally planned. And importantly, they can start to plan financially, right? I think one of the things that makes the process so devastating for people is they're blindsided by it, right? It's like being blindsided by a mortgage, you know, like, hey, I thought we were fine, and then I just found out that to have anywhere to live, I have to come up with a mortgage in a month, right? How do I do this? And so,
least with a mortgage, you do sort of know. I think the hard part with infertility treatments is you go, okay, I'll have to do one round of IVF. Well, three or four rounds later, you weren't expecting that. You think it'll work, and you don't know that it doesn't always work.
Exactly. And I think for somebody who knows that they're likely going to need to go down that path, now we see women who are literally changing their job because they tested positive. They know that it's either going to be much harder for them than the average woman to have fertility treatments work for them or to get pregnant on their own, or they need egg freezing. And they're going to work for companies that are they know have great egg freezing benefits or great fertility benefits. And if you know earlier in your life, you can start to put money away like you do. You start, you know, as a parent, you start planning and saving for college, you know. If you know that you're at risk for this kind of stuff, then there's actions you can take. So I think that bringing us out of the zone where there's this one-size-fits-all, you know, 30, 35, 40, these are the age points that a woman really sees as landmarks in her life. A lot of women, those landmarks for them are 20, 25, 30, or 25, 30, 35. And so having the information that they have that genetic risk, while, again, it's risk, right? If you don't put a seatbelt on, it doesn't mean you're going to die in a car crash, but it's a risk, right? If you smoke, it doesn't mean you're going to get lung cancer, but it's a risk. And having these genetic markers are a risk as well. And we think it's tremendously empowering for women to have that information earlier in the process.
So talking about earlier, and Dr. Amy, I want to bring you in for a quick question. And Dr. Horsiger, I know you're still there. We're going to get to you in one quick second. So when you talk about earlier, and also because this is going to be a tandem question to you in a second about the age. So men and women, we know we want to have children, both sides. So, you know, with a test like Fertilome test, I'm going to start there. Dr. Amy, do you see that this is something that OBGYN should be doing with women of what age? And Dr. Bime, what would you say about that in terms of ideal ages for women to get empowered? And then Dr. Horsiger, I want to talk about also for men to get empowered. Or is this really something that only fertility doctors should be administering? So if we could just get maybe two or three of you to comment on that, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, so what I would say is that I strongly believe that every woman should be offered a fertility health checkup, not just once in her life, but at many different intervals in her life. When you're starting birth control pills, get a fertility health checkup. When you're going in for your birth control pill refill after a year, when you're getting your IUD placed, when you're coming back for your postpartum check, get a fertility health checkup. These are all opportunities to learn about this precious commodity that we call fertility. And the thing is that women are seeing their OBGYN. So the more we can teach them and empower them and engage them, the better. They should be offering
what
the Fertilome test.
Checkup?
They should be offering, that checkup is, you know, getting your fertility levels checked, getting a fertility history done, talking about your fertility risk factors, endometriosis, fibroids. That's what it is. It's a thorough, infertility questionnaire. Most OBGYNs already have those questionnaires in their office, as many of them are using electronic medical record systems. So they have a questionnaire already. And then if someone doesn't know the answer to the question, then you refer. Refer to your local fertility doctor. Reach out to someone that you can trust and run a patient by. So that's what a lot of the OBGYNs do around here. They have a question. They call me. I'll answer them. They'll send their patients here. But if someone, let's say, isn't comfortable doing a fertility health checkup, well, you know, any reproductive endocrinologist in their area is.
Got it. Brian, do you have anything you want to add in terms of, like, you know, ideal age for you know, knowing more about your genetics?
Absolutely. So I couldn't agree more with Dr. Amy. I think one of the overwhelming feelings I felt and that we hear so many women feel is I did what my job was. I showed up at my OBGYN every year since the age of 14, right? Like, I did my work. And so I would understand if I had neglected to go to an OBGYN for 10 years, why this would be a surprise to me at 32 that I'm already, headed down the path of premature menopause. What makes so many women feel so cheated is that they did everything right. They showed up, right? And then they still got blindsided by this. And so I agree. We do have to empower OBGYNs to start the conversation. It's one of the reasons that we have started our F-Word campaign is that we want OBGYNs to realize that their patients don't feel empowered to broach the topic. And so maybe they need to nudge a little bit. And we believe that any woman who is already experiencing infertility definitely should have a Fertilum test. But we think that anybody who has a family history of infertility or reproductive conditions that can lead to infertility, like endometriosis or PCOS, should also have a Fertilum test. And I think the paradigm that Dr. Amy's talking about, where family history with respect to fertility or reproductive conditions should be worked into that a normal recurrent consultation. When women are considering egg freezing, they should have a Fertilum genetic test. And importantly, any woman who, as part of her life plans, is as plan A, that's her plan is to postpone kids, she should have a Fertilum test. This is a thing that women should have this information as a baseline, just so that they realize that, that real power in proactively managing their reproductive health is not just postponing having children, not just having that IUD put in or having that pill prescription, but really thinking about the other end of the coin. A lot of women assume, the default setting is fertility, and I need to focus on not having a baby too early before I'm ready. And then when they're ready, they say, okay, I'm off the pill for a month, restore the default setting. And they get very frustrated when they realize maybe it wasn't a default setting, and maybe being on the pill, while it didn't cause their infertility, maybe it masked years of, reproductive conditions, right? That now they've added maternal age as an additional risk factor on top of that, right? So we actually think that this should be in the OBGYN, and we think more women should have access to this information earlier in their life.
Thank you so much. So, Dr. Horsiger, I would love for you to comment on kind of all of this and how sperm complements the eggs, if you will. There's so much focus, right, on women being able to carry and the egg is so important. But as we know, sperm is so important. And it's also something that a lot of men are really ashamed of. And, I know when our doctor let us look at my husband's sperm under a microscope, and you could see, multiple tails and multiple heads, and, who knew that sperm could be so funky, if you will, for such a, non-scientific term. So, with your Episona test, and how all these at-home tests are becoming really mainstream. I know we got our 23andMe kits for the holidays. So if you could just spend some time and educate us all about sperm and the importance of these tests and at what point a man or a woman should tell her husband or, if you will, about this and the importance of it.
Sure. One anecdotal comment to make is I was at PCRS last year, which is a fertility conference that's held in the spring, and I can't remember the RE, but there was a reproductive endocrinologist speaking, and they were commenting that that frequently the male partner, the first doctor they see in their adult lives is a reproductive endocrinologist. So that is to say, men don't go to doctors really at all unless there's a broken leg involved, essentially, right? So I think we have a unique problem on the male side where educating and engaging men, I don't think can only be done through the clinic. I think there is a big effort that needs to be done online, where I think men still do quite a bit of research and I think would engage in their health more, at least in the privacy of their own home. So that's one thing that we thought was very important is to be able to provide our tests beyond the clinic. So we actually have the opportunity for patients, if you will, or users to access the test through our website. it's very much like a color genomics test where they order it. It's still physician reviewed, and then if it's approved, then it gets run through our lab, and then they get the results. And then if they are working with a physician, those results are then passed on to the physician as well as the patient. But I think men like to stay in the privacy of their own home if they can, and so we wanted to really tackle that. And I think, you know, one kind of take it up a level too. I think one thing that's not, and just thinking about how sperm contribute, I don't think it's always appreciated, is that 50% of fertility problems are at least, are partially or wholly responsible from the sperm. I think everyone really equates reproductive health or fertility health with women's health, and I think that's certainly changing, but it's in the way that it's been historically thought of. Certainly, you know, to some degree with the physicians, but certainly with the patients too. So that's another thing that we are really engaging in is trying to build an educational platform to help people understand how men's reproductive health fits in the overarching theme of fertility.
Yeah, I think that's so, so important. And everything you said, you know, I hear a lot of too, and, you know, in the community we're in. You know, if you could dive even a little deeper into it in terms of what is revealed on the test, and, you know, are you just seeing the test come into play at the point of a couple trying to conceive, or are you trying to educate men earlier, kind of like what Dr. Vine was talking about?
Yeah, I think so. The way the test, so what we do now is we look at a specific type of epigenetic mark called DNA methylation. And so that DNA methylation, of course, is a normal pattern. We have a fertile baseline that we compare each individual patient to, and then we look for deviations from that pattern. And we look in at essentially hundreds of genes, frankly, but we currently are reporting on about 24. And those 24 genes are broken up into two categories, genes that are associated with sperm function, and that's everything from spermatogenesis to capacitation, so the actual fertilization of the egg. And then there's a whole other category where we're looking at embryo development. So that's the actual proper development of the embryo, as well as essentially the immune profile, the immune system of the embryo, which is important. So we really look at those two categories. We're really trying to understand, okay, if there are problems with sperm function, maybe you want to get that patient to IVF, and specifically IVF ICSI, where you're injecting the sperm straight into the egg earlier in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there are problems with embryo development, it's essentially a counseling tool for the most part, where you're letting patients know this could be a more difficult road for you, so it might take longer, so they understand what might be causing their problems with IVF if they're unsuccessful there. But there is some evidence that suggests we might find some ways around it. So we actually have a handful of interesting cases where we've seen abnormalities in a gene set that's involved in the immune development of the embryo, and there's some thinking that this might be something that's causing recurrent pregnancy loss, at least in a subset of patients. And we've tested a few patients this way now, and there was one, we have a video on this, so if you go to our website, you can see a nice patient testimonial. They had gone through several rounds of IVF, which were unsuccessful. They had then moved on to a surrogate, and that was still unsuccessful. And then they did our test, and they found that there were problems with the immune system, or that gene that we think is helping with the immune system development of the embryo. And so that patient was put on a light immunosuppressant, well, the surrogate was, and ultimately able to carry to term. And they had twins.
Wow.
And this was a patient
yeah.
of Dr. Amy, so she can certainly chime in here. But that was a very compelling use case for us. So that's something we're exploring more deeply. And we have an abstract submitted to PCRS this year on that. But that's something we're going to explore and publish on later on.
I think that's just, a great point. I'm really glad, you shared that. And I think that's sort of been a consensus among everyone of, these tests and what they can, reveal. And I know we're getting into some of our final moments here. And I know Shweta has a few last-minute questions. But I want to start with you, Dr. Horsiger. In terms of if you had, your crystal ball, if you will, or what you're, looking at. So I have a 3-year-old daughter, right, my little miracle baby. Can you help predict what fertility will be like for her in, 20 years, if you will? Like, what is going to be available to this generation from your perspective? And I want to just kind of rapid fire this, so like a quick minute answer from each of you, Dr. Baim and then Dr. Amy. So I'll start with you, Dr. Horsiger.
Yeah, so I think I'll take it from the sperm epigenetic standpoint.
Yeah,
I mean, I come at this from a neuroscience perspective, right? So I came at it because I was very interested in these epigenetic alterations that occur in sperm. How are these ultimately inherited across generations? Can this help us understand disease risk in the offspring? And so if you look at the literature, it's actually developing support for this idea that the changes in sperm epigenetics might actually help you understand or predict risk of specific neurodevelopmental diseases, such as autism, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder. So that's something that's particularly interesting to me. And then also, I think, in terms of other disease risk, is allergy. So there's some interesting evidence that suggests that allergy might be an interesting target as well. So I'm imagining that you have an analysis done on the sperm, and then you can begin to understand what disease risk your offspring might be subject to.
Thank you. Dr. Baim, I'd love to ask you, 20 years from now, what's the fertility field going to look like?
20 years from now, every woman who's on the pill is also going to have something spiked into her pill formulation that's going to protect her ovarian reserve and protect her fertility so that she's not just postponing it, but she's also protecting it. 20 years from now, women are from their earliest OBGYN visit going to know what they're at risk for, and they're going to get a personalized fertility plan that's going to be unique for each one of them. It's going to involve some interventions in some cases. Sometimes it's about managing lifestyle. Sometimes it's about just closely monitoring things. But they're going to feel in charge, and they're going to look back at us like I look back on my mother, who tells me about how she couldn't go to the grocery store and buy pads. You couldn't do what? You had to make your own pads. It sounds like it's like the wheel hadn't been invented, And I think your daughter's going to look back and say, you went through what, Mom? That's what gets me out of bed every morning, is to bring that future to reality.
Amazing. Dr. Amy?
I would say that my dream would be in 20 years from now that there will be no such thing as needing an egg donor, because we won't need them anymore, that women aren't going to be worrying about
putting out the business.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would like to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want women to be their own egg donors, but I predict that we will have technology where we can generate an egg cell. I guess I'll use the word artificially. And we're going to see genetic testing and modification revolutionize how we take care of people. So there are a lot of things that we're going to laugh about that we did 20 years ago in 20 years, especially surrounding how we mature eggs potentially outside the body, how we won't need to potentially go through an egg freeze in the future. But right now, this is the best that we have, so we need to take advantage of it.
Right. Absolutely. Shweta, I want to turn it over to you to, make
yes.
sure we've answered all the questions we need to for today.
Well, thank you, Emily. That was a great round of questions that you had. Dr. Baim, I want to come back to you and ask you about your future research initiatives that you are involved with right now, and also if you could share some ongoing clinical trials around these tests that people can participate in.
Absolutely. So we're not ready to share the details, but one of the things that we want to be doing in the new year is to be taking these success stories that we are hearing from physicians who are using our test, where they are trying, like the story we heard from Dr. Horsiger, where the Dr. Amy's of the world are creating novel protocols, novel ways to attach these genetic insights to moving the needle forward for these patients. And we want to leverage the amazing research network that we've built. We have an initiative called the Personalized Reproductive Medicine Initiative that's brought together over a dozen of the leading infertility centers and academic centers in the U.S. And so we want to leverage that network to start making those linkages and moving these stories from, you know, one or two, you know, fertilome babies, as we call them here, to really making the standard of care. So in the past, you know, BRCA testing was not standard of care in breast cancer. Now, you know, couldn't imagine not having that as a tool in the toolbox. So we'll be working on that. And, you know, the other things that we're excited about are also expanding and really starting to move into, you know, trying to understand the male contribution and trying to move upstream. One of the things that we're noticing in our research is that a lot of the genetic factors that make it more likely for you to have an infertility condition or have trouble establishing a pregnancy also put you at risk for successfully carrying that pregnancy to term without complications. So things like preeclampsia, et cetera, are very much in our line of sight at the moment because they're also related biologically.
Okay, thank. So would you also like to comment on the clinical trials that people can participate in this field?
So what I would say is keep an eye on our website. We will be making we'll be making some announcements soon. We were really excited last year to partner with 23andMe. I think that came up earlier, the genetic testing company on launching a fertility community. Right now, we were oversubscribed. That was amazing. We were oversubscribed for that study, and we're now tracking those women across 18 months. We'll be announcing more studies that people can participate in later this year.
All right. Thank you for your answer, Dr. Baim. Dr. Horsiger, I would like to ask the same question to you about the clinical trials that are ongoing around genetic tests that men can use and participate in those clinical trials.
Yeah, I think I probably, again, don't want to give too much detail, but we are looking at a couple of different interventions, both one being a surgical intervention and one being a drug intervention. So I would say if people feel like that would be beneficial for them to participate in a clinical study with us, we'd be certainly willing to talk to them and talk to their physician about their participation. So I think that's what I'd say about that.
All right. Thank you so much for your answer. And I guess we have some questions on our website from the listeners. So I'll be asking them one by one. The first question says, we have two kids and want another one, but we are having a hard time conceiving since last 1+ year. Do you think these genetic tests can help us in any way? Dr. Amy, you can start with an answer, and then Dr. Baim and Dr. Horsiger can follow.
Absolutely. I mean, what I would say is it's a bumper sticker. I'm just joking. I don't necessarily have it on my car, but previous paternity doesn't equal current fertility. And so just because sperm was awesome, when you had that baby, things can change. Things can change with our egg counts as we age, just like things can change with our sperm. And the other thing that patients find surprising is when I say, let's do fertilome, and they say, but I've had two kids. I say, this is genetic information. Things can change as you get older. You know, just because you have this gene doesn't mean that you're not going to have problems now, years after you had your first baby. So I think that there definitely is value to still do a full workup, even if you didn't have problems with baby number one. And that's one of the greatest fertility myths, is that if you didn't have problems having baby number one, then you should have an easy time having baby number two. And I think people spend too much time not getting tested because they believe that myth. So with these tests, people can get their answer sooner so that they're not frustrated at home wondering why things aren't working.
That's such a good point.
The other thing that I'll add is that some of the conditions and the risk factors that our genetic tests for are things that get worse as you get older. So, for example, we talked about the immunological issues. So we know from the autoimmune disorder world that sometimes age can contribute, and that women can have issues that maybe are very subtle or undetectable. And maybe in your case, you know, you were younger. And so whatever those subtle differences in your biology were kind of patched over by the fact that you didn't have, you know, advancing maternal age as an additional factor. But then as you got older, then maybe that was like the extra straw that broke the camel's back, if you will, on a reproductive condition. And so I still think that even if you didn't have trouble getting pregnant with your first or your second, if you are struggling now, you are older now, it's still worthwhile to understand biologically under the hood what could be going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just, if I can just jump in there, I think that
sure.
One thing that's not well appreciated too is paternal age. Paternal age is a absolute factor, and we certainly see epigenetic changes as a function of paternal age, and these changes are definitely in regions that are important for fertility. So yeah, I everything that Dr. Amy and Dr. Byrne had said, I wholeheartedly agree with, and this is represented also on the male side.
All right. Thank you for your answer. So there is one question that just came up on the website, and it says, what is your vision of in vitro gametogenesis? Do you see this possible in the future? And if yes, in how many years? And there is a similar question which says that, could you please give your opinion about the news of some days ago about oocytes grown in a lab by a UK team? So what is your vision about in vitro gametogenesis is the question.
I can start with that. Yeah, I mean,
sure.
Absolutely. I do see it possible, and that's kind of what I said. In 20 years, we won't need an egg. We won't have the need for egg donors because we will be able to take, let's say, a skin cell and be able to convert it into a mature egg cell. So I do see that happening, but not anytime soon. And
yeah.
As far as the story on being able to mature eggs in vitro, you know, 3% mm-hmm. of the eggs that they were able to culture turned into an abnormal mature egg. So mm-hmm. we're a long way off, but that study was extremely futuristic, and that stuff excites me because if people don't realize this, those eggs were actually extracted or ovarian strips taken from women who were undergoing a C-section, so they didn't even have to go through IVF.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was such a fun study to read.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I did my PhD in egg biology effectively. And I share Dr. Amy's excitement, and I think we need to be investing so much more funding in the private sector, in, you know, government funding, into pushing this work forward. I know so many of the lead scientists in this field who have literally had to retire early or become cancer researchers because there's not funding for this research. And importantly, that study was out of the UK. And so, I think it's exciting, and it's exactly why we should be doubling down on research. But two, I do hear sometimes from physicians that they worry when these really exciting stories get so much press that then it discourages patients from taking advantage of the best opportunities that they have today to start their families. Maybe they're reluctant to move on to egg donation or to surrogacy, and, you know, they see these articles and they think, oh, I'll just wait until this new technology is ready for me. And I think it's just really important what Dr. Amy said to point out that while this is very exciting, these are baby steps. And this is not something that I think will be solving somebody's fertility difficulties in the short term.
Mm-hmm. Right. Dr. Horsagar, would you like to comment?
Just a small comment too. I agree that this stuff is pretty far out, but nevertheless is very exciting. I think another area that's very exciting is the CRISPR-Cas9 technology, where you can actually do editing of the genome. And
mm-hmm.
there's some evidence now that suggests that you can actually do editing of the epigenome of DNA methylation as
right.
well. And so I think at a certain point, as you're trying to optimize your gametes for fertility, it might be that you could do the editing straight on those cells and get them ready for optimal fertility.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much for all your answers. And I guess it's time that we wrap up this session. We are already above our scheduled time. So thank you, Dr. Amy, Dr. Baim, Dr. Sagar, and Emily for your wonderful and very informative discussion. And thank you for taking time out from your busy schedules to share all the knowledge with us today. It was a pleasure having you with us today. And audience, I thank you for your support, and we look forward to having you all join us for our upcoming Fertility Cure Talks on Endometriosis in March. That is the Endometriosis Awareness Month. And if you would like to propose a talk for fertility, or if you would like to be one of the fertility talks, please email me at shweta@trialx.com. And for more information on upcoming shows on Cure Talks, please visit our website, curetalks.com. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.